So the thing started out as quantum Bayesianism, maybe with this paper. But the main idea was to introduce, basically treat all probabilities in quantum mechanics as Bayesian degrees of belief. And it was a collaboration with Carlton Case and Chris Fuchs. And then later, Chris Fuchs took this idea a lot further and turned this idea into, I'd say, a full-blown interpretation of quantum mechanics, which he called cubism, and this is where the word first appeared on this paper. And then even more recently, David Merman, suggested to see cubism not just as an approach to quantum mechanics, but as something even broader, an approach to science. So, as I just said, cubism takes all probabilities as personal degrees of belief, and by all means all, this includes probabilities 0 and 1, and also probabilities derived from pure quantum states. And then by the Born rule, you get immediately the conclusion that quantum states as well are personal judgments of the agent who assigns the state. So that's basically the core of the idea here. Okay, now, locality is, I think, a key principle for any cubist. So we all know that quantum mechanics isn't non-local like that, so the question is, how does one capture that? So we want locality. Taking locality seriously gives you a number of, negative statements. So the first one is, cubism rejects the EPR criterion of reality. And that's sort of necessary to block the original 1964 derivation of Bell inequalities. Cubism also rejects Reichenbach's common cause principle. So Reichenbach's common cause principle is the idea that that any correlation should be explained either by a direct causal connection or by a common cause of the two events. And in the form of the idea of local causality is the core of Bell's 1976 argument for Bell inequalities. So cubism rejects that too. And finally, cubism also rejects the assumption of an ontological model, so a lambda. Ontological models underlying the PBR theorem and other recent no-go theorems. So it looks like a pretty negative thing. It looks like you're left with rather little. And so this talk is mainly about saying, well, it's not the case. You actually lose virtually nothing. So I'm going to talk about cubism's notion of reality, locality, and causality, and show how they do not depend on either of these ideas. Okay, so let's just take them one in. Basically we'll now visit each of these in turn and in the same time develop ideas about cubism. This is the EPR criterion, very familiar. If you can, without in any way disturbing a system, predict with probability equal to unity the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. That's the famous formulation. And of course, it depends crucially on this idea with probability equal to unity. So it has to do with probabilities here. And so in order to analyze this, clearly we need to talk about probability. And this is a brief slide summarizing the personalist Bayesian approach to probability, which was pioneered by De Finetti and Ramsey before the Second World War, and then made useful later by Savage and Jeffrey and many others. It's become a mainstream approach to probability. It's agent-centered. A probability is a number assigned by an agent, and that's in this case just a user of probability theory, to an event, to quantify the strength of his or her belief that the event will happen. so far so good, but that of course doesn't tell you much about how they use it. So you need to complement this with something operational, and it's formalized and axiomatized in decision theory. So the agent uses his probability assignments to make decisions in the face of uncertainty, and they apply to single events as well as to repeated events. So very suitable for looking at single quantum systems. And well, they're personal. So different agents with different beliefs, but in general, assign different probabilities. That's a feature of this approach. And the rules of the calculus, probability theory, has a normative character in this. So it's not descriptive. It's a normative thing. It tells you how you should make decisions. And these rules can be derived from the requirement of no sure loss. This has various names in economics, but the simplest version of this is called Dutch book coherence. I'm not going to amuse myself and show you a little version of a Dutch book argument, which I stole from Wikipedia, and which is actually quite neat and really shows the idea. So let's look at a three-way horse race. And assume that a bookie offers these odds on the three horses, even 1-2, 1-3 on the three horses. So now, let's say I'm a bettor. I think, well, this looks like fair odds to me, and so I'll just make a compound bet. So I bet $120 on the first horse, 80 on the second, 60 on the third. So I want to hedge my bets in some way. And so basically, I put $260 on the table. OK, now I can actually look at each. I mean, there are three cases. Horse one or two or three wins. So if horse one wins, well, the payout will be $240. Because I was offered even odds. But since I put 260 on the table, I lose 20. Horse two wins, well, the same happens. I lose 20. And if horse three wins, I also lose 20. So this seems to be a pretty bad deal. That's the kind of sure loss that the Dutch book argument talks about. So what's wrong? I mean, clearly there's something wrong. I shouldn't have accepted these odds in the first place, at least not in a way to inform my compound bets. So what's wrong? I mean, basically, what's wrong is hidden by the unfamiliarity, at least to most physicists, of odds. I mean, if you look at probabilities, it's much clearer. Well, OK, first there is the sentence here, which I now interject. This is now a single run argument. So it's not like roulette, where you're certain in the long run, which underlies maybe some frequentist ideas of probability. But no, the bettor will lose $20 with certainty in a single race. And what's wrong comes from the implied probabilities. So they are 1/2, 1/3, and 1/4, and they just don't add up to 1. They add up to 13 over 12. So you basically, by accepting these as fair odds, well, you're just violating the normative rules of probability theory. And that basically can be made into a full derivation of the probability rules. How? Well, you define a set of probability assignments as you say they are Dutch book coherent. If they rule out the possibility of a Dutch book, because this kind of thing where you just lose with certainty in for every single outcome is called a Dutch book. So the Dutch bookie tries to make money. Well, it's the Dutch book clearly is a particularly clever bookie. If he can find customers, then he has it made. But now there's an easy theorem that says that an agent's probability assignments are Dutch book coherent if and only if they obey the standard probability rules. So that means that just basically by requiring that you can't be Dutch booked, by requiring that you do not want a sure loss, or that you don't want your probability assignments to lead you to a sure loss if you use them for decision making, you arrive at the probability calculus. And that's the Dutch book derivation of probability. So it results in theory with a normative character. I stress this because I would say the same thing about the quantum calculus, quantum rules. Okay. Now we come to the Eppiacco theorem of reality. Now, I mean, probability ones are just probabilities. There's nothing special about them here. Basically, what you mean, well, if Alice is certain that horse one will win, well, that means her probability for horse one to win is one. It's just a probability assignment. And so this means, according to this decision theory scenario, that she is willing to pay any amount up to $100 for a ticket, for a lottery ticket that pays $100 if horse one wins. That's all it means, nothing more. And in particular, it does not mean that there's a real property of the world that guarantees that horse one wins. It's just about her betting preferences. And that basically tells you why, if you take this approach of probability seriously, you should reject the EPR criterion. OK, just take some water. Let's move on to Reichenbach's principle. Here comes something that mirrors what Czaslaw just did in his talk about remote causality. But here I want to just I'll talk about something I learned from Rob Speckens. So the causal network formalism developed by Judea Pearl. So I mean, it's a very simple formalism. You have events that are causally connected like this, and then what this means, how this translates into constraint on your probabilities, just like this, that the joint probability for all three random variables decomposes like that. P of x, P of y has a given x, and P of z has a given y. And if it decomposes, and so basically this enforces this decomposition here. Now, well, this, of course, is just, I mean, this is just about correlation in a way. So you want more. You want the idea of a free choice. And in Pearl's formalism, this takes he formalizes it like this. He introduced this idea of doing something, of forcing this random variable y here to have the value little y. And that would be in an experiment would correspond to randomizing this random variable, for instance. And so then the probability decomposes, well, P of x remains P of x, but now y is set, and the z variable just depends on this here. That's basically the idea. Now, if you apply this to a bipartite scenario in the usual way, well, then this just writing down the constraints on the probability the distributions like that gives you the Bell inequalities. So it gives you Reichenbach's common cause principle. It gives you parameter independence. So the probability for x, well, this is, I mean, I should, I didn't even say this, but this is, you can think of this as basically a Bell experiment with settings A and B. And just in order to be perverse, I just chose it just the other way around from Czaslaw. Maybe he was the one who was perverse. I don't know. It's very unfortunate that there's no way of getting this sorted. It's very confusing. But different people have different conventions here. So you get automatically these two conditions. So the probabilities of x, even given z, do not depend on b. And furthermore, the probability of x given z, a, b, and y, do not depend on y. It's outcome independence. And so you get Bell inequalities. OK. So here's something I mean, tells you, in my view, why this whole framework for causality isn't sort of applicable to quantum mechanics. And this is a theorem by Wood and Speckens. So very quickly, any account of quantum correlations within this Pearl framework requires fine-tuning. And now I have Rob sitting there, so I hope I get this right. So here's an example from Bohmian mechanics, for instance. Bohmian mechanics, what the theorem means is that any account of quantum correlations, so you can write down any set of arrows or any causal influences you like, you will always get this idea of fine tuning here. And here's an example from Bohmian mechanics. Bohmian mechanics violates parameter independence. So given z, which in this case incorporates the hidden variables, given the z and the hidden variables, you can signal. So the probability of x depends on the setting of the other side, given the hidden variables. So it allows signaling given Z. Now that's no problem because for a Bohmian, because you can guarantee that there is no signaling by just choosing your probabilities, the probabilities P of Z and P of phi of X given Z A and B, you can choose them in a particular way, and this is guaranteed by the theory, so that that you get the observed no signaling principle here. But the idea of fine tuning here is that, well, this no signaling, then if you do it like this, does not follow from the causal structure alone. It requires a particular values for these choices here. So it requires this kind of fine tuning. And so inference from this, the conclusion from this, this is the word. My conclusion from this is that this is not the right concept of causality to use here. Because in this framework, the natural causal order for a Bell experiment leads to a conflict with quantum mechanics and Bell inequalities. And any causal explanation of quantum correlations in this framework requires fine tuning. So this is why cubism rejects it. Okay, so let's move on to logical models. So again, Speckens, Harrigan and Speckens define ontological models. And in an ontological model, very briefly, for any measurement on a physical system, the outcome probabilities are determined by the system's real properties, lambda. So that's what the ontological model is in one sentence. Okay. So assuming lambda, plus some further assumptions, you get no-go theorems. PBR, Kolbeck and Renner, Hardy, long list of no-go theorems. So cubism rejects lambda and therefore is immune from these no-go theorems. So, and that's a very old idea, of course. I mean, Schrödinger to Sommerfeld, 1931, he wrote this, one can only help oneself through something like the following emergency decree. Quantum mechanics forbids statements about what really exists. Statements about the object, and I interpret this as statements about lambda. It deals only with the object-subject relation, even though this holds, after all, for any description of nature, it evidently holds in quantum mechanics in a much more radical sense. So that's the idea of rejecting lambda is not new and is maybe not that radical. So then, as well, but isn't this rejecting realism? And well, I would say no. In a technical sense, it is, because people have defined realism in a clever rhetorical move to just mean exactly that, lambda realism. Of course, so ontological models are often described as a definition or given a label realism. But of course, there are other ways of saying what's real in the world than lambda realism. So labeling cubism as non-realist is misleading because cubism attempts to make true statements about the world, and I'm going to say a bit about that now. But these true statements just don't take the form of a lambda. So it just rejects ontological models. Okay. Now let me say something about measurement, because I'll come back to causality later. In cubism, a measurement, I mean, as basically it's just a feature of quantum mechanics elevated to a principle. A measurement is not reading off something. The word measurement, I mean, John Bell wanted to ban the word measurement from quantum mechanics for very different reasons. But cubists have the same, would also like to do that because a measurement somehow suggests reading off a value from something. But of course, in quantum mechanics, a measurement is an action, is active. So a measurement is an action on the world. It's an action of the binary agent, and it results in the creation of an outcome. This is what the quantum measurement is here. And now, maybe the radical consequence from the personalist Bayesian idea that I think Chris Fuchs introduced into quantum Bayesianism and therefore turned it into cubism is the second idea here, that the measurement outcome is not objective. It's not a classical pointer reading, like let's say in most Copenhagen versions, but it's personal to the agent who makes the measurement. So we then come to something which looks, I mean, it's an agent's first person perspective, really. So quantum statements, if I'm the agent, a quantum statement is my personal judgment. A quantum mechanics is a tool to organize my experience, the outcomes of measurements for me. And a measurement is an action on the world I take to elicit, well, a new outcome for me. It's all about me. Yeah, that's why it's all about me. This is actually, this is David Mamet's paper about cubism. But of course, I mean, there's several things you should say about this. This is not, I mean, it's about me, of course, also about you. Any user of quantum mechanics is me, it could be me. So it's a formalism that any user of quantum mechanics can apply. That's the first thing. Secondly, this idea that it's all about me is not at all really unnatural. Because, I mean, let's say you're faced with the task of applying quantum mechanics. I mean, what's the basic things you must assume to apply quantum mechanics? Well, I mean, you're a physicist. You want to apply quantum mechanics. You need these things, these assumptions, which are really the key assumptions of cubism. I need a distinction between myself and my external world. I make experiments on the world external to myself. I need to assume my ability to experience, to just experience measurement outcomes. And I need to assume my own agency, my ability to act freely on the world. Free action, surely. So these are all, I mean, these are very natural assumptions. Without them, it's very hard to see what it could even mean to do science. So the starting point is very natural. Okay. Now, here's what is at the core of the main technical. I mean, cubism has one aspect which is a rederivation of quantum mechanics, which is a reconstruction of quantum mechanics, and it's based on the Born rule. The Born rule is fundamental here. The Born rule is like and so how does this work? It is in a way a formalization of Feynman's dictum that the double slit experiment contains all the mystery, all what's important about quantum mechanics. So this is in a sense a departure from the sort of the mainstream foundational reconstruction programs where bipartite systems are always sort of fundamental. That's always the fundamental idea. What happens in bipartite systems? And so because the double slit experiment is very fundamentally about one system, a single system reconstruction. So I mean, here's the thing. You have a quantum state, and you make a measurement, arbitrary POVM here, and this, let's say, is the measurement of the interference pattern on the screen in your double slit experiment. So you have outcomes J from 1 to M. It's an arbitrary measurement, arbitrary POVM. And now, and this is the Born rule. Now, let's introduce the slits. But instead of just having two slits, I introduce d squared slits. Let's have a d-dimensional quantum system, and I introduce d squared slits, and let's assume that the slits represent the d squared outcome of an informationally complete measurement. Now, informationally complete measurements exist for any dimensions. They're easy to construct. A simple construction. So I'm not talking about symmetric ones, but just ordinary informationally complete measurements. You can always write that one down for any dimensional Hilbert space. So, you can even find rank one ones. And so, in that sense, then, the measurement outcome, especially your measurements, your which slit measurement, fully characterizes the quantum state of your system here. So the quantum state is equivalent to the probability distribution of your measurements at the slit. And similarly, you can also write down the probabilities of where on the screen it will align, given which slit I pass through. Probabilities R of J given I, so probability of where on the screen I am, J, given which slit I, and they fully characterize this measurement POVM here. And the answer is a very simple step. of writing the Born rule as a rule fully of probabilities. So Q of j becomes then some function, and in general it's a complicated function, and if these are Sieg symmetric information computer, it becomes very simple. But it is a rule about joining up probabilities here. And so the technical program of cubism is to derive, basically from this formula, you derive all of quantum mechanics. It's progressed well, but we are not there. Or what does it tell us about the Born rule? Well, it provides a connection between my probabilities for the outcomes of different and, in general, incompatible measurements. So what I mean here, well, I mean, the Born rule connects my probabilities at the slits with my probabilities at the screen. And these, of course, are incompatible. You can't do them both at the same time. And you can basically write the Born rule like that and interpret it like that. So this is a very different perspective from what one often thinks about the Born rule. Because, I mean, naively, you might think you have a physical property of your system, the state. And then the Born rule gives you probabilities. And so it sets probabilities. But this is different here. Here the Born rule just connects probabilities in different situations. And so it becomes very much like the rules of probability theory. It then acquires a normative character. It really answers the same question as the Dutch book style probability theory. How should I gamble? But unlike probability theory, which can be derived from Dutch book coherence arguments, no sure loss is enough, this is, the Born rule is empirical. It has a lot of content. It might carry within it all of quantum mechanics. So it's definitely a statement about the character of the world. Well, often here's a solipsism. It's a silly question. Just because one talks about me, one isn't a solipsist, because the first assumption of cubism is this distinction between me and the external world. And so assuming a constant external world is nothing a solipsist would ever do. Here's something a bit more substantial. So here's something one can say about reality. You see, I mean, quantum mechanics, there's lots of things we know about it. For one thing, it refuses to give a mechanism for what particular outcome comes about. So you could phrase this as saying that quantum systems, even the simplest, have an interiority, which we can't penetrate. And that's part of their reality. And another way of saying the same thing, any part of the world has intrinsic freedom. Since a quantum state is really about my gambling commitments, my quantum state doesn't put any restriction on what the system is going to do. It's just a more general version of the rejection of the EPR criterion. Even if I predict something with certainty, if I gamble in a particular way, that doesn't tell the world how to behave. So that's this freedom idea. And of course, the world can be changed. When I act on it, it changes. And well, last comment on maybe solipsism. You could formulate sort of as a Copernican principle that I am not special. So if I apply quantum mechanics to the world around me, then I would apply quantum mechanics to you to model your behavior, and you would be a physical system for me. But of course, by this Copernican principle, I can also act as a physical system, and then you would apply quantum mechanics on me. So when you and I take actions on each other, then something real is shared between you and me. But for consistency, what we cannot have and what quantum mechanics rules out is a third-person account of this something, which is a lambda. Okay, now let's go back to the networks here. So, I mean, something that's very familiar, and I was going quickly about it. Let's just compare this scenario here. X influences Y causally, and this constraint with this one here. And you see that these formulas really don't tell you anything at all. Any probability distribution can be decomposed like that. So really, you need to go to the second part of the formalism, doing something, settings, choosing an outcome. And then if you do it here, if you do y, then you just get p of x. But if you do y here, you get p of x given y equal to y. So this distinguishes the two causal situations here. So what the, and since we wanted to, we need to modify it for quantum mechanics, well, the clear strategy is to abandon this bit here and just keep that. That's what I want to do. And I mean, this is in a sense, it's a very obvious thing. It's very similar to all the things that Chast have just said. Basically, because I mean, any random variable in quantum mechanics arises from an action. You choose to do an action. So there's a free choice of what action to do. And then you do the action, and your random outcome follows. So each of these, I mean, the whole diagram is personal to an agent. It's just a constraint on one agent's probability, on my probability distributions. And these come always in pairs. So I choose action A, and I get outcome X. And so the agent freely chooses, I freely choose A, and experience outcome X, et cetera. So in this here, what this says is then X, when the only thing you read off from this is that X is not in the causal future of B. Okay, so then this constraint on my distributions is that I cannot influence X by my action detect on B, and therefore this conditional probability here should be independent of B. And that's really the only constraint I get from this. Okay, now I can just, I mean, a very natural definition of locality is that I can say a probability assignment is local with respect to a given causal structure if, well, basically I'm saying that the probability for if I have any set of nodes which is not in the causal which are not in the causal future of some choice here, some action, then I the constraint is that my probability should be independent of the action I take. The probability for these nodes not in the causal future. And that sense, quantum mechanics, of course, is local. It results in local probability assignments. Okay, so then here, in this bipartite scenario, locality then implies, well, in this case, conditional no signaling, parameter independence, but not outcome independence, and it guarantees no signaling without fine tuning. So it's, in this sense, clearly the right thing. I now would like to finish by just giving a brief relation to the recent foundational work by Kolbeck and Renner. I mean, these causal networks, this sort of kind of obvious idea, is they are essentially equivalent to the causal networks that Kolbeck and Renner introduced in their work. Well, they don't require they require transitivity, but that's really not important. And so, and our definition of locality with respect to the causal structure is essentially equivalent to the A and B are free with respect to the causal structure. It's just the idea of free choice. But one of the main theorems now takes a very can give in a very nice cubist spin. That's what I'll show you here. So the theorem is that in this typical bipartite scenario here, that if you assume quantum mechanics, you assume a maximally entangled state here, and then A and B, they correspond to measurements to a chained Bell inequality, which was invented by not Judea but Philip Perl and Bronson and Caves a while ago. And so if you do that, then you can show, or they show, that if you assume any probability distribution like this, you assume some lambdas, so that even given lambda you can't signal. Both way around, similar for y. Then this alone gives you that lambda is where are we? That lambda is irrelevant. So the probability cannot depend on lambda in any non-trivial way. So basically, in another way of saying this. This theorem is spectacular in a way because it requires only what's called parameter independence here. Unlike the original Bell inequality, it does not require outcome independence. So the spectacular strengthening of Bell's original argument. But furthermore, you can give it a spin. Any hidden variable theory that's local with respect to this causal structure is trivial. So what we get then is the comparison between Bell and this cubist reading of Kolbeck and Renner. Well, in Bell inequality, you start from an ontological model. Or if you like, you derive the ontological model from the EPR criterion of reality, plus perfect correlations, plus some counterfactual reasoning. Or you have an ontological model. And then you define local causality within that model. And then you derive a contradiction with quantum mechanics. Now, if you now reject the ontological model, you might seem that you're left with nothing, and that people have made this argument. Norsen, for instance, made the argument that you're left with nothing if you do that. So it seems natural to just abandon locality. But this version is the other way around. So you can now, you define causality and locality as part of an agent's belief structure, just as I did in this almost trivial way. And then you show that any hidden variable theory that respects this belief structure is trivial. Of course, we know that Bohmian mechanics doesn't, but okay. So now, if you reject the hidden variables, you just reject the hidden variables. You lose nothing else. And that's the end. Thank you.
Aside from positing its existence, what does cubism say explicitly about objective reality?
It says nothing explicitly about lambda. Because it rejects the lambda idea. The reality that quantum mechanics describes, it is not about the objective reality. It is about how agents should behave, should gamble, should make decisions in the real world.
So it's not does cubism about, say anything about the real world?
It says things about the real world. For instance, it says about the real world that gambling, that the Bohn rule should be used for gambling. Now, that is a very substantial statement about the real world. It also attempts to say things about what happens if two agents meet. But that's more speculative and it needs development.
So I want to ask you about cubist explanation of Bell correlations. I think we agree to large part, but there's something that I think still remains undone, and I want to see what the cubist version of that is. So I agree that it seems a promising avenue to secure a local or a causal explanation of Bell correlations to refine, to change Pearl's framework and abandon classical variables and abandon classical probability theory as a description of our knowledge of those variables. But maintain a distinction between causation and correlation, as you've done using, you talked about the due conditionals and the regular conditionals. But to my mind, that project is incomplete until you can interpret the quantum formalism in a way that cleanly distinguishes what's about causation and what's about inference. And to my mind, that's the project that kind of remains undone. So in particular, what I don't know how to do is to talk about quantum mechanics in a way to do not just inferences about, I did these preparations, then I got this measurement outcome, mm-hmm. but to do inferences that are retrodictions or inferences that are pre and post selections and inferences about some number of variables towards some other number of variables for any given causal structure there is. So I'm just curious, what I have not seen cubism try to attack any of those kinds of inference problems? And I'm wondering if you agree with me that it should handle that problem.
Well, maybe I don't. I mean, my first attempt would be to rephrase, for instance, your retrodiction problem effectively as a prediction problem. So I'm not sure these are real problems. Now, I'm also, let me see, at the beginning, what did you say about the difference between inference and
causation and inference,
and
causality. Influence and inference.
Well, I mean, I would say that really both. I mean, causality is just a part of my. I mean, a causal structure is part of my belief structure. So in that sense, it's just an extra constraint on my beliefs and therefore on my inferences. So I think about this differently than you. About retrodiction, amongst statisticians in the sort of 10 years ago, there was one almost lone dissenter against the Julia Pearl framework, and that is Philip David, who essentially used the same framework, but he rejected the idea of counterfactuals, maybe more retrodiction, and he basically claimed that he can have the same power of inference just from a purely predictive decision theoretic framework. And I think I would like to make maybe the same distinction between you and me there.
So you're using his influence diagrams, is that right?
The influence diagrams are, yes, exactly, they're similar to his in some respects. But I mean, of course, he has the things that I rejected here when I said my strategy was to abandon one and keep two. So he, of course, his inference diagrams include that, like Pearl's.
I'd like to query you a little bit more about the objectivity, or actually the idea that measurement results are not objective, but so what will be the working definition of objectivity, in a sense that in all formalism, I think, we use that the measurement outcomes, whatever the classically registered one, are agreed upon all parties involved in the process. Isn't this universal agreement an objectivity, or is it just insufficient, and you would call objectivity something else? So what would be the precise?
Well, I mean, I would say objective is something that is not agent-dependent. So, I mean, I would call the Born rule objective, but the outcome's not. And I would say that this agreement between agents, when several experimenters get together and agree on the outcomes, that's an observation. That's something you find, but it's not something that's guaranteed by anything in the formalism.
No.
So, I mean, you could, of course, then say, yes, you could regard that. You could make a working definition then. If it's just a definition of something you find, if you say, well, I call this, if you happen to agree, then I call this objective, fine. I mean, I'd be happy with that. But I haven't really thought much about how
so it's basically not part of working formalism. Whatever definition of objectivity you can give, it's not.
But I mean, it's not. It's not. I mean, the important point from my perspective here, from quantum mechanics perspective, is that there's nothing in quantum mechanics that enforces this objectivity, that enforces this agreement. And that is, I mean, in a sense, it is really the same. This is the same idea as the rejection of the EPR criterion of reality. So, I mean, even if I predict with probability one that my students and I will see the same thing, right? That doesn't mean, if we reject the EPR criterion, then it does not entail that there's anything in the real world, a real property of the world, that enforces that we all see the same thing. I mean, taking these things seriously. It's taking rejecting the EPR criterion seriously, I think, leads you to that. And this is what cubism tries to do, being really consistent about these ideas.
Yeah, it's just a short comment. So the existence already is somewhat older interpretation of quantum mechanics that has very similar ideas. It's the relation of quantum mechanics from Pablo Rabelli. I don't know if you know about it. So, I mean, it has, many of these elements that is more about the relation between observer and system, that they are not, that measurement outcomes are not objective. The state is a belief and so on.
Nobody heard you? Is that what happened?
Sorry to hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. So it was more like a comment. So there exists already somewhat older interpretation of quantum mechanics from the 90s that has many similar ideas to cubism, which is relation of quantum mechanics by Carlo Rovelli. And also in there you have the rejection of objectivity of measurement outcomes. It's more focused on the relation between observer and system, and the state being, you know, state of knowledge of the observer about the system. So it shares many of the conceptual ideas that are in cubism, but it doesn't really have all the technical ingredients and books in the Bond room. So I don't know if you were aware of this work.
Well, I happen to be aware of it. Actually, I mean, there are crucial differences. When you say it's not, I would say it isn't worked out. And maybe the biggest difference between Rovelli's relation quantum mechanics and cubism is that that Rovelli enforces consistency. So basically, let's say I'm an agent and I assign a quantum state to describe my expectations of a measurement on a system. Then for Rovelli there is a higher order. There is you can always introduce a third observer for whom who describes the whole system consistently as one quantum system, etc. So there's two things. First of all, in cubism, that's absent. There's no mechanism that enforces this kind of consistency, because it's really an alien from the idea that the quantum set is personal. So this consistency is not required. Secondly, Rovelli, to make his thing work, needs to define quantum states with respect to any quantum system. So, for instance, one electron would have a quantum state with respect to another electron. Now, I mean, that almost precludes the idea of viewing these quantum states as agents' degrees of belief.
The generalization of it.
No, it's not a generalization of the idea, but it is. It is abandoning the idea. Thirdly, I mean, I think in the end, Rovelli's system merges into many worlds. Because if you take this idea seriously, you're always taking a higher order view, and then regarding the whole thing sort of as one pure quantum state. It just merges into many worlds and inherits the problems.
I disagree on the last thing.
I'm just curious. If you take this Born's rule as so fundamental, when usually in quantum mechanics it's derived from this Gleason's theorem and so on, which is not easy to prove. So I wonder if in this formalism there are other things that we always take for granted or almost a starting point in quantum mechanics, like, I don't know, linearity or convexity or things like that, which are hard to prove. Or I wonder if the hardness is hidden in the existence of Cqvms.
Well, I don't think so. So yes, I mean, the idea would be, and the hope is, that by taking the Born rule as fundamental, and say you're taking a simple, something I didn't show, the simple expression it takes, simple form it takes if you assume the existence of Cs, and then derive lots of things we take for granted. For instance, bipartite scenarios. I mean, that would be derived rather than assumed. But the hardness is hidden in the existence of the Cq problem. I don't think so, but the reason I don't think so is that if you look at what we did on deriving the structure of quantum mechanics, deriving sort of deriving the shape of Hilbert space, deriving the subset that is equivalent to Hilbert space in the D squared dimensional simplex. Seeks don't play any role in that. Because we just start from the Born rule in the simple probabilistic form, and quantum mechanics doesn't exist there. So it looks like it's just independent from that. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Related to this question, I don't see why there could not be a Bayesianist, the same kind of approach for any generalized probabilistic theory.
You might be able to.
Because if that's the case, then you would need extra ingredients to single out quantum theory.
The Born rule is this specific form of the Born rule is a powerful extra ingredient. And then, yes, wouldn't it? I think that's an interesting question. And I'm not sure that would it be true that every probabilistic theory would be amenable to? I would have to look in. It's something that I've wanted to look into for a long time.
Yeah, I don't see why not.
It actually raises a good question in a sense, but some of the co-authors distinguish between classical things and quantum things. Like when we talk about the question of now, also the first is difference. So that means that it seems like there is an additional reading. How do I know if I'm the Bayesian, whether I'm in the classical world or quantum world? If there is, I don't know, do you have any feeling what would be needed to act on a broad Bayesian philosophy towards the probabilities in order to single out that?
I know the answer to that. Dichotomy between classical and quantum at all here. So I think, the idea of Seebism. This is what we refer to. Seebism, I think, is a misunderstanding. Seebism is the idea of applying cubist ideas to classical questions.
So we know in advance that they
are. But that's not so. So the question is the following: quantum versus classical. Now, if you take this double slit experiment idea seriously, then you can view the Born rule as an addition. It's fully phrased in classical terms. It's about classical probabilities for outcomes, for actual outcomes. Compare two different experiments, one where you measure which slit you go through and one where you don't, classical probability theory doesn't give you any guidance on. It doesn't connect the probabilities because they are different experiments. Now, all that quantum mechanics does is add something. It adds an additional rule. It's an addition to the classical world. It doesn't replace it. It's an addition. It gives you extra power. It gives you new situations, quantum situations, in which you can now assign probabilities where before the theory would have been silent.
So I think that because quantum mechanics is we don't want to get really too much out of the schedule. Let's right now thank once again for the guest. If you don't mind a shortened topic break, let's